to me. Oh, oh, I despise costing me destruction of this life. Warm me his tears, 10,000 of mothers I have, when their sons go out to fight and lose their lives. I said, war!
This is Comics Therapy, episode 30. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from February 12th, 2014. Think Tank number 12 and Manifest Destiny number 4. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and this week on the couch, we talk with writer and artist Dan Goldman. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Hey, this is Charles from Panel Culture, leaving my nerd confession of Best Fight. It's tough. I think you have to kind of put it in two categories. It's got to be the superhero one and the non-superhero. And for me, probably the best fight I've read in the last 10 years is from Scalped. Bad Horse and Shunka. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Shunka? Drink. Anyway, it's from Scalped Volume 9. It's like a three-page epic battle where they both get really messed up. And it kind of made me feel sick to my stomach reading it. So that is up there. Superhero battle, I guess I would have to pick. It's from a while ago. It's Incredible Hulk number 340, and it's Wolverine versus Grey Hulk in this epic battle where Wolverine really holds his ground, which I really like. Obviously, Hulk ends up sort of getting the better of him in the end before it's broken up, obviously. But yeah, it's an epic battle drawn by Todd McFarlane, which is fantastic. I haven't read in a long time, but I believe there's a part where Wolverine almost cuts him in half, which is pretty awesome. So that's my nerd confession for the week. First nerd confession ever. I feel like I've accomplished something in my life now. Thank you.
You're a little slurry today.
I've had a couple beers.
Excellent. Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is war. Good God, y'all. Apropos of nothing, our friends Ben Bailey and Joey Esposito from the Assemble After Dark podcast have declared war on Aaron and I. I don't fucking know what that means either. It's kind of adorable. Just roll with it. It was especially cute how they tried to get their listeners to clog up the nerd confession line with odes to AC/DC. Nice try, boys. Better luck
next
time.
Yeah, we got two calls.
Aw, that's so cute.
It was cute.
You should all check out their podcast, however. They may have lost the war, but they still do an entertaining show. My favorite so far has been the Back to the Future episode. I'll put a link up on the Comics Therapy site so you can check it out. In the meantime, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to talk about fighting, especially since it's Valentine's Day. It's so meta, I can't stand it.
Can we also put links to, like, the people we love, too, since we have an enemies list and a friend list?
Do we actually have an enemies list?
Well, I mean, a list of one is still a list.
Oh. Okay.
Right? I mean, we can always add to it.
Sure.
I mean, I'm hoping, like, this is the beginning of something, you know, epic.
Is it?
It could be.
Okay. Sure. We can put up a list of who we love as well.
Okay.
Are we talking podcasts or people?
Both. It'll be like a Nixon-style list.
Okay.
A blacklist?
Seems problematic, but I trust you.
It's thematic.
Thematic. Got it.
Hi, it's Lila Gwen, and I met AC/DC in a bar in Philadelphia in the early 2000s. They had just had a show, and I was introduced to them, and I stood up and immediately gave, like, all of them hugs, and I was wearing heels, and I'm a pretty tall gal anyway, so they basically just got a face full of cleavage, and really all I saw was hats. So they say it was AC/DC. It could have been just a bunch of really short guys in hats. Crap. Bye.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to share the best fights in comics, be it mano-a-mano, epic team battles, or romantic spats. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site on Twitter and on Facebook for your convenience, and the rest is up to you.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, @AndreaShock, and Aaron, @AaronMyers. And, of course, the show account, at Comics Therapy. So, Aaron, are we fighting too? Is this, like, all-out war, like, Walking Dead style? I don't really know what that means because I'm not caught up, but I just want to know, are we cool or are we fighting?
Don't we always have, like, a simmering kind of angst between us? Isn't that our thing?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's any more than usual.
Okay, that's cool. I just didn't know if I should be, like, bringing out the big guns here.
No, I mean, the show is young. There's a lot that can go on.
Got it. How was your week?
Oh. It was all right, I guess.
Yeah?
I bought a lot of comics.
This is absolutely unsurprising and also well within the norm.
But I bought a lot of comics by selling some comics, which was exciting.
Wow. What did you sell?
I sold two comics. I sold my copy of Preacher number 1 and my copy of Man of Steel number 17.
So Preacher number 1 because of the television deal?
Yes. I bought it for $15 a few months ago.
Okay.
And I sold it for $225.
Damn.
Yeah. That was a good one.
And Man of Steel, why?
It is the first appearance of Doomsday.
Okay.
Who is the rumored villain in the Superman-Batman movie, apparently.
Why would you get rid of that now?
Well, because I've got 4 copies of it.
Oh.
And people are buying it for like $25 a piece.
Got it.
So I took the worst copy of mine that really is sort of like a dollar bin issue, and I just put it up there for, you know, buy it now for $25, and somebody did. So, whatever.
Okay.
I went out and bought Spider-Man comics.
What'd you buy?
Well, I actually took the time finally to go through and see like what issues I'm missing, so I knew what to look for, and went and bought a bunch of Amazing Spider-Man stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I like Spider-Man.
Riveting.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. You asked about my week. It usually involves comic books.
It does. You're very predictable. I like to have that consistency. You're the anchor in my life. So.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I mean, really, besides comic books, what did I do? There was a lot of snow.
Right.
And the snow was kind of melted, and so we got out of the house finally. And been realistically trying to spend as much time with one of our dogs as possible.
Yeah.
She nearly died a couple of weeks ago from internal bleeding from a ruptured tumor on her spleen. And so we had sure her spleen was moved, you know, an emergency procedure. And, you know, the biopsy comes back as a malignant tumor, and not to bum people out, but the average life expectancy is 18 to 84 days.
Wow.
So, you know, we're trying to make the most of the time we have. It sucks getting old. And she's really not that old to me. She's only 10 years old.
That does suck. You are bumming me out.
Well, careful what you ask for. So, she's been feeling pretty good, So, you know, going to the park like normal, trying to keep things normal and, you know, just appreciate time where when you get into the routine of the day to day, you don't necessarily take the time to appreciate the moments you have.
Sure.
So, you know, if we get a couple months, I'll be thankful for that. And hopefully when the time comes, it's as painless and, you know, easy as possible.
Good philosophy.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was that soon.
It's very fat. It's very fast moving.
Man.
Yeah. So.
Fuck cancer, dude.
Yep. It's not great. But you know, if dogs teach you anything, it's to live in the moment, because they really do. They'll remember the past, but you know they're here in the now.
Right.
And
kids are good for that too.
They grow up though, as long as everything's fine. You know, dogs. Dogs are here for a short time, but they're very childlike. So, yeah, not to bring things down. I mean, in a way, there's a positive side to it. You know, we get more time with her than we thought we were going to that night, you know, a week and a half ago.
Right.
And, so just make the most of it. And I guess that's my advice for everyone.
Shit, I feel like instead of talking about war, we should be talking about, like, rainbows and puppies and unicorns and stuff.
War is good for some stuff too. It's good for discussion.
It is good for discussion, hopefully. I mean, we're sort of banking on the fact that it's good for discussion.
I think so. I could talk about war all day long.
It's kind of creepy, dude.
What about your week?
Pretty busy, just in terms of balancing all this stuff in the house and out of the house. I did manage to watch the first episode of The Walking Dead on the television. Well, on my phone, mostly. Which turns out is actually about the size that I can handle that intensity. Mm-hmm. I gave myself a break after the first 20 minutes. Don't laugh. I can feel your patronizing response building. But the visual is obviously much different when it's like a moving source of media as opposed to like a black and white comic book. And let's not forget the fact that those first, what, two arcs were all about the zombies for me. That's like still a thing.
Yeah.
So it's mostly the anticipatory zombies that I have a problem with. So like the, gosh, if anybody remembers like when he first is up in the hospital and like goes down the stairwell and it's pitch black and he's got fucking matches to see his way, which is a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. That was a little bit intense for me. I was fine. I made it through and I finished that episode. So now I have to decide if I'm going to continue watching. I have to admit, I had like a little bit of whining about the fact that it wasn't exactly like the book. And I don't know where the hell my entitlement over The Walking Dead comes from, because I haven't even decided how I feel about this book.
Well, we established that last week. You love this book.
I don't love it. But, like, I have no right whatsoever to say, what the fuck? This isn't the same as the comic. Blah. Like, shut up.
See, I was really happy that it wasn't. Like, I think the comic, as much as we love it...
Dick.
It has some things, especially when it translates to TV, that pacing-wise, that could have gone better. And, you know, especially things with Rick that, you know, are hard in a, you know, real, like, you know, visual sense, you know, like a, whatever, TV or movie, that are hard to portray and carry on. So as long as it keeps to the spirit of the book, exactly. I have no problem with them changing the plot at all.
I just needed somebody to smack me upside the head and remind me that that's the process of translating a story from one medium to the other, which is certainly not a foreign concept for me. You know, being that I do theater, like I really don't. This is me baring my soul and saying like that was just dumb. I don't know where that initial reaction came from, except that partially when it's a story that I know that is going to be intense and like kind of right on the border of what I can or cannot handle, like visually and horror wise. If I know what's coming, I certainly do much better with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when it changes, then shit, suddenly there's, you know, things to cause anxiety because I don't know how they're going to play out. I'm glad I watched it. I'm not going to binge watch it, but I'll probably check in on it here and there. Because I'm not watching it with anybody else. And so there's no external pacing that will keep me tied to it. But I was...
The first, like, I'll tell you right now, like, the first season is okay. Second season's better. Third season's better than that. You know, it gets better every season.
It's in the current season, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, what they just, I mean, it's not a spoiler because you've read the books. Like, the current season is, like, the prison, you know? Like,
right.
So what just happened in the show is they just...
Don't tell me what just happened
escaped
in
the prison. Well, they just escaped the prison.
Well, okay.
It sticks to the story. It just doesn't stick to the story in the same order that the story
And
comes
I know
in.
That there's been consolidation of characters and there's been some changing of the roles the characters have played. Like, really, it was somebody, when I was whining about it on Twitter, somebody said, like, hey, it's just like every other comic book adaptation. Like, the Avengers did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
There's the spirit of the story. Again, I apologize to the universe for that moment of entitlement because I don't know where it came from, but I'm fine now. Like, whatever.
Yeah, for now. There's something else you'll feel entitled about.
Yeah, I'm kind of a brat. Thanks. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, what are your thoughts on, like, tiny little local cons? So here's some background for you. There is one here in the East Bay on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So setting aside the fact that I'd have to drive over to the East Bay, which is a pain in the ass, because I'm a brat. I grew up going to those in Pittsburgh. There were probably three or maybe even four every year. And they're small. They're mostly vendors and maybe a couple of guests. I don't remember panels, but I was younger. There was always an art contest. And I did remember this, that so I won a bunch of those art contests drawing ElfQuest drawings. So I was like 13, 14, which tells you both what I was drawing at the time and like what the judges were into.
That's funny.
Yes. But in terms of a way to spend a Sunday afternoon, if I'm not a collector, which I'm clearly not, what do you think that experience is going to consist of?
I think those local, like the smaller local cons, you have to have a different mindset for.
Right.
So like there's one in Portland in April that's sort of working itself out to be like the replacement for the Stumptown convention.
But that's still even bigger than I think I'm talking about here.
Well, this isn't Stumptown though. So this is like 40 tables.
Okay.
Total. And that includes vendors and, you know, and creators.
Right.
So that's pretty small.
Right.
That's not that big. When I look at the list, I recognize some of those people as Portland names. They're all mostly Portland people, but I don't know most of them. So like my mindset for that is there's like 40 people I can talk to during that time, that day. And I need to also change my expectations of, what I'm going to get from a con like that.
Right.
You know, because this is going to be a lot of independently published things, you know, people's first works, whatever, you know, they printed it on their computer at home, that sort of stuff. Doesn't mean it's bad or good, whatever. It's just different than like a Wizards World. So I think your expectation for going to that con this weekend should be to see a bunch of people who you have no idea who they are.
Right.
Be kind of open to having them tell you who they are. And for me, the hard part is then not feeling like I have to buy everything from everyone, you know?
That's always like, your problem, though.
No, but it's not hard for you to, like, walk up to a table, have somebody tell you about their cool independent comic that they've, like, poured their heart and soul into and go, like, okay, thanks, and walk away.
Yeah, it's really hard, which is why I don't tend to do it that way.
Right. So, but those local, those smaller cons, like...
That's the majority of your interactions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Yeah. I just haven't been to something like that in...
Or there's cosplay contests, and there'll be, like, you know, gaming tables.
I honestly don't even know if it's that extensive. I have to go back and like, look at it. But if it's anything close to what I'm picturing, which I haven't been to since I feel like I wasn't able to drive the last time I was at this type of con.
Because you got so drunk?
No, because I was under 16.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
What the fuck?
It's just a question. Jeez.
What kind of... Wow. That... Okay. No, because it was that much longer ago. And so...
Sure. Well, because there weren't cars yet.
You just, like, from one... Are we fighting now? Like, that's what we're doing.
Look, I told you, anything is possible today.
Okay. I just wanted to know if you thought that it would be, like, worth spending my Sunday afternoon checking it out.
I think so. I think that's a different kind of experience than you've obviously done in, you know, a long, long, long time.
Long. Quite long.
Keep yeah. Going. Right. I would, for me to feel comfortable, I do research.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean you have to, but if there's names on there, if there's links at least, it's nice to check out to see what people do so you can maybe jot down a few people you might want to talk to.
I'm familiar with the concept of the internet. I was going to do that.
Yeah, there's hyperlinks usually embedded into a website, which you'd look through on your computer's web browser.
Got it.
You know, like back in your day, you'd go to your links,
Netscape?
You know. Oh, I was thinking more like you'd connect, you know, to links. Your text-based browser and, you know, connect to your local library or something like that. Dial up your war games.
Can there be a CompuServe joke in there somewhere?
Sure.
Prodigy right. Or something? I
right.
Don't know.
Mm-hmm. AOL keyword.
Aw. Good times.
Yeah.
That's all. Those are the things that I had on my mind.
Yeah, and you might not spend as much time there as you would a bigger con.
I want to try to see the Lego movie, too, so I don't know if I can fit in all of this excitement.
Well, they're usually pretty cheap, too.
Yeah, I think it's $5.
Yeah, so, I mean, you don't have a ton invested in it. You go in, you walk around, maybe you flip through some long boxes of stuff, you know, of the local comic shop that came with their, you know, back stock.
Yeah, but I'm in the process of getting rid of all of my physical comics, so why would I...
Because you bring more to me.
That's true. Should we tell the universe that, like, you're getting a whole bunch of totally worthless comics?
Yeah, but I think I should be getting all of your worthless comics.
You're not.
I know. I should be, though.
Very clear choices about who gets what based on, really, who I like better.
Yeah, well.
So you get all this shit.
Right.
Sorry.
That's cool.
I mean, you can have X-Force number one. Maybe two copies.
Is it still bagged?
There's probably one that is, and there's probably one that isn't.
Yeah, all right. I'll take the bagged one, because it's a collector's item.
You want to talk about current comics?
Sure. Let's do that.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. Jason Sachs here, at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Calling to talk to you about my favorite fight ever in comics. It's tempting to pick out one of those classic Marvel battles between the Thing and the Hulk, between the Avengers and the Defenders, the Civil War and all the battles that came from that. Even some of Thor's best battles have been against preventing Ragnarok from happening, or against some of his most awesome enemies. But really, I'm such an Alan Moore fanboy that I have to go with my favorite battle as being the fight in Miracle Man number 15. At least that's the original Eclipse issue. We'll see what the issue is that the reprint is from Marvel. But this is the most epic battle that I can remember ever reading in comics. Just like Alan Moore to go over the top and present a completely destroyed, devastated London full of collateral damage when two incredibly powerful, incredibly thoughtless heroes battle to defeat each other. The battle between Johnny Bates and our hero is just magnificently dark, magnificently brilliant, and magnificently terrifying, showing what superheroes would be really like if they lived in the real world and if you and I were just ordinary people who are caught in the middle of everything. It's a magnificent issue. I can't wait to reread it. The art by John Turtleben is breathtaking. And Alan Moore's story is just sensational. It really is one of the best comics of the 1980s, and I can't wait to have another copy of it again.
Our first book this week is Think Tank number 12, written by Matt Hawkins, drawn by Rashaan Ekdahl. I think that's right. Ekdahl?
I would put the emphasis slightly differently, but go for it.
And lettered by Troy
Pateri.
Oh, man. Think Tank is published by Image Comics. I got that part right.
This is the conclusion to the second arc of this book. The story of Dr. David Loren, a math prodigy who's basically living out his life in indentured servitude to the government. Think worst case scenario of Tony Stark's weapons legacy. Loren can design and build anything, and he's in pretty bad shape mentally in the last six issues. He had previously successfully escaped from the base, got the girl, retired to a tropical island. But the girl worked for his CO, the tropical island was staffed with agents, and the retirement was just a ruse. So we've seen him at his lowest, and as a result, his strategy for dealing with the situation has turned darker, more daring, more insidious. He creates a chemical weapon that isolates genetic makeup, so only specific ethnic groups can be targeted. He was hoping that this outrageous and egregious development would result in oversight and reform from within, but things didn't really turn out how he planned.
Yeah.
This book is so good.
You're welcome.
So good. You get 100% of the credit, Myers.
Thank you.
This, I had never even heard of this book, which is, first of all, can we just...
That's a travesty.
Step aside and speak about, yes, it's a travesty, and I feel a little sad about the state of things that a book of this caliber would be just not even on my radar.
I
agree.
Or a lot
of other people's.
Don't make
it personal. Like, let's be honest and real here that it's a lot of people aren't reading this, and one of the things that the creators have been very frank about is that they believe that it's because it's in like gray tones as opposed to in full color.
Yeah, but you know they, with the next arc, it's going to be in color.
Absolutely. So they're stopping and taking stock and restarting in such a way that is ostensibly open to new readership. Although I urge you guys to go and pick up the first 12 issues because it's just so... The writing is really too bad.
Yeah, it's really too bad, though. I really like Rashaan's, like, I'd like that black and white. I think his black and white is really good.
I think it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And this is delving way into just fawning slash very positive review territory, but I don't know. I walked away from, I burned through all 12 of these in one night, and I walked away thinking that that was the most well-packaged story that I have read in a really long time.
Yeah.
Yep. Anyway.
And military type stuff too tends to have a very a more narrow audience, I think. And this doesn't lend it. I don't think this is something that you have to be a, I don't know. It's not a military book in that way.
It's not at all.
No.
I wouldn't put it in military category.
I wouldn't even put it politically necessarily either, you know?
A bit, but not much. To me, it's much closer to the spirit of some of the like science books that are really hot right now.
Yeah.
I think that Lauren has the same like hipster science vibe that I'm trying to think
like a black science or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, like in terms of a protagonist who is really fucking smart and a total pain in the ass, like that's a very popular combination right now with FBP and with black science and with piles of books.
But rooted more in reality, you know, like
it's
definitely taking things that are available, you know, to us currently, you know, it's not really breaking the bounds of possibility.
True. But in a lot of ways that makes his like mastery of it a little bit more compelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And the commentary on war and the war machine and that sort of thing is very good. It doesn't feel like it's a liberal call to action, you know, like, oh, this is, you know, war or the terrible things that, you know, whatever.
Well, I guess because I mentioned it in the summary, just in terms of contrasting Lauren with Tony Stark, I mean, he sees the purpose of a weapons development, like the need for weapons development. He sees the role he plays in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
He struggles with it intensely. And he especially struggles with the like direct link that he plays to death. And when he witnesses that, it's incredibly difficult for him. But he's not a pacifist at all.
Yeah.
And I think that is very, very intriguing to take a relatively young, hyper smart character who has just so much potential for destruction. And the comic book norm would be that he walks away from that all to, like, I don't know, embrace humanity in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And he dives in and creates something that's just so disgusting and so terrible for all of the wrong reasons. And then he has to deal with the consequences. That's kind of awesome.
Yeah, and I think it's also a little more realistic. Like, it's not the cynical attitude of, like, oh, you know, the government's bad, the army's bad, but war is hell, and any advantage is taken.
Yeah. I think I disagree with you in terms of it not being political, though. Now that I'm just kind of sitting here thinking about especially the events of the last couple of issues.
It doesn't feel like it's a liberal agenda book or anything like that, or, you know, Republican or Democrat, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but you and I are speaking from our point of view.
Maybe.
Like, it's not a liberal agenda book, but to say that it doesn't have very...
I think it's like more... isn't it more the warning of, like, the Pandora's box kind of thing? Like, especially this last arc with a virus that could be genetically, you know, targeted. That's the kind of thing that you wouldn't want loose in the world. Because once you create it, you can't put that back in the box.
Sure.
It's that whole... It's the nuclear bomb problem.
Which they reference. But I think in this case, it's taking it to a much more personal level.
Yeah, it's the modern, but it would be a modern day equivalent.
But so much more so. The targeting, and especially because the example that they give in terms of like Israeli and Palestinian conflict is just so relevant and so, I mean, it presents this problem that they have to solve because ethnically there's some overlap. So like, gosh, how are we going to come up with this disgusting chemical weapon that's only going to kill who we want to kill?
Yep.
And what's the accepted percentage of casualties on the wrong side? And so I guess that it is very political in that regard, mm-hmm. but it's very real.
Yeah.
As opposed to pushing a specific agenda, which I guess is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, it kind of makes me think, like, this is, knowing we were going to do this show, it's the, you know, that's that question, like, what's war good for? And it's really good for innovation.
Oh, God, that's so cynical. I hate it so much.
It's not cynical. I think history proves it, that our humanity's greatest leaps in technology and innovation have always come during wartime. And I don't know if that's a commentary that because we are a warlike species, we thrive on destruction. Destruction breeds creation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. How is that not cynical?
It's not cynical. True. I think it's just realistic. Okay. I think if you just look at the past, you will see our species has not evolved, but grown more during conflict.
Is that something to be lauded, or is that just factual? And so we're response to it. We're just going to put it out there that this is what it is. This is what we're capable of. And
I don't know what a social Darwinist would say. You know, is it the kind of thing that should we then embrace our warlike, you know, natures? Should we embrace war in a more scientific way, if that makes sense? You know, we strive for peace, but the reality is we are constantly at war as a species.
Yeah, it's just very horrible to think about the consequences of packaging like all of that in the terms of like perpetuating conflict.
It makes me wonder, though, if we weren't fighting against our nature to kill each other so much, would humanity be further along?
I think that's the worst thing that you've ever said.
It's a question. I'm not proposing that we do it. It's just a question. Like, I don't know, would we be colonizing other planets and would we have discovered new life on other worlds and be killing them right now?
But how many examples are there of innovators and great thinkers who came from adversity themselves? And so in a state of constant conflict or conflict that is escalated way beyond what we are living in, which is pretty constant in and of itself, those individuals like wouldn't have survived.
I would also say we live in a society that for the last 60 plus years has enjoyed superiority over the rest of the world because of our victory in a world conflict.
You're speaking specifically about America.
Yes.
I'm speaking more globally, that individuals around the world who have been great innovators outside of the United States have come from war-torn areas and areas of conflict and areas of like Great Depression and just a completely different socioeconomic climate than what we have here. And in your model, they would be less likely to grow and like propagate and be innovative themselves.
I don't think history would agree with you.
About which?
About that innovators would not, that people with the capability to, you know, revolutionize humanity would be lost to conflict. I don't know if that's how the human organism works.
You know, there's just something that like allows them to periodically slip through the cracks of destruction and devastation.
I just think like an Einstein partly half because of circumstance and half because of capability.
Okay.
You know, that there are more people capable of that given the right circumstances. They're not unique snowflakes, you know, that are plucked out of the, you know, whatever.
Got
the,
it.
The snowpack.
But if there's a catalyst that is catastrophic enough, it's going to push them towards genius?
I think the cream rises to the top dependent upon need.
And if the need is war, or the need is survival, I guess, would be mm-hmm. the corollary yeah. to that?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Pandemics, whatever, you know?
That's just a terrible way to live.
It's a terrible way for individuals to live, but it might not be a terrible way for a species to thrive. I think during a time of peace and quote-unquote prosperity, at least without conflict, mm-hmm. The herd becomes very docile and kind of sickly.
Sure.
You know, so a constant culling of the herd keeps the organism healthy.
God, it's just the words. I'm like bristling at some of your word choice. I think it's just a.
Should I have done a supervillain laugh at that point?
No, I think that we're just not far enough removed from times when that was attempted.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree. I don't agree consciously with like eugenics or anything like that. I mean, obviously, like, well,
holy
I mean.
Shit.
No, but I don't want to make it seem like I'm advocating a case for it, you know, for like
okay.
for Holocaust or genocide or anything like that. I mean,
good.
Obviously, especially given my family's history, not a great thing.
Right.
But if you look at things historically and how humans, you know, how we've made leaps and bounds in innovation, like the computer age is a result of World War II, you know, and that has taken us further along in the last 70 years than we have in the last 700 years.
I don't disagree. My favorite book is Cryptonomicon, after all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I gotcha. It's just kind of depressing.
It is. I think it's a depressing kind of reality of where we are at evolutionarily.
You know who I blame for this? Ben Bailey and Joey Esposito.
Sure.
We could have been talking about unicorns and puppies.
All right, so it's safe to say that they are the Hitlers of podcasts.
I can't believe you fucking went there.
Is it too early in the show to go that far?
There's never a good time for that. Moving on.
All right.
Yeehaw! AC/DC rules!
Our second book is Manifest Destiny number 4, written by Chris Dingus, drawn by Matthew Roberts, colored by Owen Gienny, and lettered by Pat Broussard. Manifest Destiny is also published by Image Comics.
Your little
did I get any of those
questions.
Names right?
Yeah. The little question raised voice that you do it's adorable.
Thank you. What's this book about?
Well, is there any other way to summarize this than to just say it's the story of Lewis and Clark? The expedition is set in an alternate reality where the middle of the country is populated by magical beasts. I almost said cannibalistic, but they're only half human. And parasitic flora, which kind of acts like zombies. We're only 4 issues in. The balance of information to reveal has previously been set at a slow burn, but this issue we meet Sacagawea and Toussaint Chaboneau. The balance shifts slightly in favor of the humans again for a bit. So generally, this is just historical fantasy horror awesomeness.
Yeah, or is it reality?
Oh,
is it the untold story?
This is the kind of war story that I can get behind because it's less real and therefore more forgiving, and I don't get depressed because it's just awesome.
Yeah, it's less real, but it also is drawing upon the real horrors of settling the West.
Absolutely.
So that part is pretty cool. You know, I like it was a pretty brutal expansion of the United States for everyone involved. And I always loved that term of manifest destiny. You know, that it was the right it was our right because we were here to settle and conquer. I also always kind of found it interesting that there's a lot of guilt, you know? So I don't know what it is, like, the white man's burden of our decimation of the native populations of the United States,
mm-hmm.
where they were fairly warlike to each other as well. It goes back to humanity killing each other no matter who we are and where we were.
Always.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, the conquistadors came into South America and basically wiped everyone out or subjugated and enslaved them.
Right.
But they were also doing it to each other, too. You know, it wasn't like a peaceful, you know, innocence. People came and then these Europeans come and decimate them. I mean, God.
I don't think I agree at all.
Oh, my God. All. The Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayans, they would sacrifice tens of thousands of people at a time.
I think that you cannot make a broad statement about literally hundreds of different cultures across.
But you can't say that about all the settlers of the United States and South America as well.
Okay.
But I would say every culture, broadly in a sense, was in conflict, and still is. But there was never a time where a peaceful culture was decimated by a warlike culture. I think humanity is always with guilt. if you look at history.
Okay, I want to tease this out a little bit because I'm like shocked how much I don't agree.
Okay.
But maybe it's just that I don't understand, and also I live in a bubble where everybody gets along.
Sure.
Okay, so you're saying that there has never been a point in history where a peaceful society, a truly peaceful society, was wiped out by one that was like warlike and just looking to conquer for the sake of conquering.
I'm not saying never, but
okay,
I would say by and large. Every group of peoples would have conflict with another group and might makes right.
So is your point primarily that there has never actually been like a truly peaceful culture?
Yeah. I don't think that's in the nature of humans. I don't think we're capable of it because there's a need for survival, and survival inherently comes with conflict. Like how do you have resources without conflict?
Communism.
Yeah. Okay. The communist cultures have really worked out very well.
Well, none of them have actually really subscribed to the philosophy very accurately. So
we're back to reality where there's never been a culture like that.
Okay. But there actually hasn't been like a communal society that was.
I mean, there are enclaves. You could point to enclaves within societies, but that's not really what we're talking about.
Right.
You know, you could point to groups of people who have tried to make that happen. But at the same time, they still have outside influences. There's not... The only way that could happen, I guess, is if you colonized some remote planet that was separated completely from everything else. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's still a matter of time before it comes within contact of another culture. Mm-hmm. You know, you find these isolated tribes in the Amazon or something like that, you know, that have been never seen another people, but... It's, you know, over the reality is that it's not that long in terms of history that these groups have been isolated. And then what happens? They get wiped out.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're peaceful. It just means that they've been isolated.
There is a lovely moment in Manifest Destiny that I can't remember if it's in the third one or the fourth one, where their first reaction to like the giant like minotaur that isn't a minotaur is to shoot it.
Right.
And they kill it. And then later, when they come across the, like, plant zombie guys, they're mm-hmm. like, hey, maybe we should try talking this time. Like, hey, what's up? And they come and, you know, attack them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I giggled because who's to say that the first reaction would have gone differently if they had attempted to talk to the minotaur, not minotaur thing. But the, like... After the fact, like, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe we should do this in a less stereotypical, like, fight first, ask questions later way.
Yeah.
Didn't work out so well for them either.
Nope. And I think history shows you that too. Like, parlay usually doesn't work out. First tie up your enemy, bind them so they can't move, then ask them questions.
Man.
Look, that's just war 101.
I guess I'm not very good at war.
No. This is why men rule the world.
That's the second worst thing you've ever said.
Thank you. Are you sure it's not the third?
I don't know. What would be the middle one?
Well, we had the Hitler comment.
Right.
What else did I say? That we all should be at war so we can be better people or something? I don't know.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of hits. There's a lot of quotable quotes from this episode.
Mm-hmm. How are you drinking? Is that...
Yeah.
Still?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm most quotable when I've been drinking.
I'm glad that you're feeling better so that you can start drinking when we record.
Yeah, it was a rough couple of weeks.
It was. You and me both, my friend.
Sobriety is a cold slap to the face when you have to do a podcast with you.
With me?
I'm just saying.
No, I think that your like general approach to both of these books is so much more like hardlined than mine, which is not surprising. But I guess I'm more surprised about it in Manifest Destiny, which is, I'm not going to say it's like a fun-loving book. It's
no, it is not. It's terrifying.
It's not light at all. It's, I think, what did I text you? Like, oh man, this is really fucked up. And you're like, do you not like it? No. I think it's great. But let's be honest, it's pretty fucked up, but in a really delightful way.
And clever and like engaging. It's not a rehash of anything.
Right. I like alternate history stuff, especially when it introduces things outside of like a realistic genre. So this is great. I think that is an extra layer, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that helps to isolate my, I don't know, like actual empathetic reaction to these characters, because they're not as real to me as, say, like David Lauren is in Think Tank.
Sure, yeah.
So I was crushed when he was betrayed. I thought that sucked. And in this, it's...
You could watch a Buffalo Soldier get skinned and not.
I'm not necessarily rooting for the people as strongly in this one as I wasn't until like they started eating them. And then, you know, maybe I had to like stick with my traditional loyalty lines.
It's good that cannibalism is there.
It's not cannibalism. I mean, they can't come up with what they're calling, like the reoccurring joke about Minotaur, not Minotaur, is excellent. But there's got to be another word for it when you're half human and you're eating human. I don't know what that is, but...
I don't know. Delicious.
I'm going to have to edit all of your comments.
It's going to be a very one-sided conversation.
It is. No, this is good. I think that ending on this kind of war is more appealing to me than, you know, the first kind.
Well, I don't have a good transition because it wasn't a war or a conflict.
You never do.
Nope. But do you want to not talk to our guest this week about war, but about philosophy and creation and, I guess, the war of getting wonderful books out into the public?
It's a bit of a stretch, Myers.
It's the best I could do right now.
Yeah. Let's talk to Dan Goldman, who is a phenomenal artist, fantastic writer, and the one-man show behind Red Light Properties.
Let's do it.
Hey, everybody. This is at Charming Red here, the mom who reads comics, and one-third of Comicosity's The Hangout video podcast. And I just wanted to confess my love of Cupid. Not the little chubby baby with diapers who shoots arrows into people's butts, but my father. Because my father and my mother would pretend to be Cupid every year around the time I started realizing the ins and outs of how Santa Claus really worked. And so they thought they would just throw another creature into the mix who gave presents. And most of the time it was just little candy and things like that left in our doorway and for when we woke up in the morning. Well, one year I had been going on for weeks about the Indiana Jones Trilogy VHS box set that was coming out. I was so excited about it, but I knew with my brother going off to college and everything else that was happening, there was no way I was ever going to see that box set. Well, I wake up Valentine's Day morning and there it is sitting in my doorway. You would never see a little girl so excited and squealing over Indiana Jones the way I was. And at that point, Cupid officially became cooler than Santa Claus.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer, artist, designer, and digital media extraordinaire Dan Goldman. Dan's ongoing series, Red Light Properties, is published digitally by Monkey Brain Comics and available on Comixology. The brand spanking new hardcover edition is out this month from IDW. Dan's website is a dynamically interactive tour of his other work, from the Eisner-nominated webcomic Shooting War to the nonfiction comics journalism 08, A Graphic Diary of the Campaign Trail. I highly recommend everyone check it out. I'll link to it on the Comics Therapy site. Thanks for talking with us, Dan.
Thank you.
Yay.
You know, we just started and you already got something wrong.
Oh, damn it. What did I get wrong?
Red Light Properties is not a hardcover this time.
Are you serious? It looks totally like it's a hardcover in all of the pictures you posted.
Yeah, no, it's gorgeous, but it's a paperback.
Ah, well, I'm not disappointed, except in myself for getting that wrong, but it looks so fantastic. I can't wait to actually have it in my hand. That's great.
It feels better in your hands. I'm really happy to have this thing in print. It's been a long time coming, and
yeah.
I spent a lot of hours and blood and tears what's the other one? Calories.
Right.
making it what it finally definitively is. And I love it so much.
That makes me really happy to hear.
Yeah. I'm so itching. Like I'm already, you know, most of the way through the second book. It's just, I can't wait to get it out there. I wish I could fast forward this year, but still have the nice memories.
Well, besides Red Light Properties, is there any other projects you want to talk about that you're working on right now? You know, stuff we can expect up in the future?
Yeah, in between the two books, I'm doing this really cool project it's for the Indian market, and it's called Shiva Destroys Sex. I think that's the American title. I think for obscenity law reasons, we have to change the name for India. But I'm doing it with some guys as part of a larger transmedia project in India that is using Hindu iconography, gods and whatnot, to talk about the problem of rape nowadays in India.
Oh, wow.
And so we're basically using, we're doing this like Hindu god mashup epic and creating a new myth within the space of Hinduism that is designed to make people think about, you know, what a woman means when she says no, and why you should love and respect them and their bodies. And
is culturally in India, is sort of the you know, I know a lot in like a lot of Muslim, you know, like Middle Eastern countries, just a woman really has no right to speak out if she's sexually violated. You know, is that something that's a problem in India as well?
I don't want to speak definitively because I haven't been there yet. I'm going out in December when the book is already done. I'm going to be at the Mumbai Comic Con and do some other festival stuff there. But I don't know if that's the case, but I do know that a very old value system there is, and it is actually, you know, unpopular and shitty as it is, it's also the case here that if a woman is raped, they're considered to have like less value for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
They're dirty, you know? And I've heard people in the US say that kind of thing, or like, wow, if your girl got raped, could you still be with her? And like that kind of thinking, I think, is really deeply ingrained in, you know, sort of machismo.
Yeah, male dominated society, sure.
And it's and so, you know, that's one of the aspects that we're trying to address. But I get to draw elephant gods and monkey gods.
How do you balance the message, which is obviously incredibly important, with, and it's sort of interesting you brought this up because we're going to talk a little bit about this in a bit, but with being culturally sensitive, like framing it within the existing Hindu mythology, how do you balance those two?
It's tricky, but also there's this tradition in Indian culture of nested stories, okay. Story within a story within a story, where things are operating on multiple levels, but also multiple stories at the same time. And I don't know if you ever saw this book. It was republished by Vertigo, and it was really a big deal for me in college. That was called Rogan Gosh.
Mm-mm.
No.
Mm-mm.
It's Peter Milligan and Brenda McCarthy, who, when they work together making comics, are like genius. And anyway, I cannot say enough good things. I don't think that book's in... Oh, you know what? It's the book is not in print from Vertigo anymore, but the Dark Horse collection, The Best of Milligan and McCarthy, that came out about 2 or 3 months ago, the whole thing is in there.
Oh, cool.
Oh, okay.
I cannot recommend that hardcover to cool comic kids enough. I mean, that those are all pieces of comics, short form stuff and long form stuff. I owned almost everything in that book already, and I got to get it in like a slicker production at a larger size, and I love that book so much. Anyway, so that book that one long story, Rogan Gosh, works on a couple different levels where there are five stories, and what Milligan says in the preview is you can read this book a number of ways, and if you decide that any one of these stories, you know, A through E, is reality, then all the other ones change meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little puzzle, but I thought that was the neatest thing when I was in my early 20s, like, you know, doing lots of drugs and stuff and reading comics. And I just thought that was brilliant. And what I didn't know was that idea is actually something that is rooted in Indian religious texts. So it's cool. So anyway, how to get that across? I am trying to approach it with the idea of nested stories, and the guys that I'm working with are really, really intelligent. And I want to be able to pull this off and make a difference using comics and the other media that we're going to extend the story into. It's something I believe in because I'm an atheist, but I am also a worshiper of women. I think, and I don't mean in a sexy way, although I that too, but really I think that women are more evolved than men in a lot of ways. And
I hope that everybody is taking notes right now, because this is brilliant stuff.
No, I seriously though, like, women can make life, you know, I mean, and what that does to you as a psyche and as a not as an organism, but as a being, which is a higher thing. I think that if men could have babies, I think they'd be better beings.
Interesting.
Yeah, but then it's also, I think, evolutionarily, we're in a transitionary phase, you know, sort of like rising up out of the forests and the plains, you know, to a more evolved culture. But we're still, especially men, are still very much stuck and rooted in that kind of animalistic nature too. We're 100 years away from that kind of like breakaway, you know, from the kind of the baser instincts.
I don't think the baser instincts are ever going to go away. I think we're always going to salivate as we think about fucking, you know?
Yeah, but don't you think it changes when the hierarchy of needs change too? Like, you know, thinking about, salivating about fucking was important in propagating your genetic material, and you needed to do it a lot because most of your offspring wouldn't live. And that changes when you have a society where your infant mortality rate is much lower, you know, so the genetic pressures change. And I think part of, you know, just evolution in its own way is it responds to the environment. So if the environment no longer requires that as much, I think that also changes like male and female and kind of the drives.
I agree with you. If the universe and if evolution revolved around America.
Sure. Yeah. Well, obviously, that's a very first world centric kind of view. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just spent the last 3 years in Brazil, and like, you know, was it William Gibson who says that the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed? And that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
And so...
Or if we're going back to talking about India, that's very much true as well.
Right, right, exactly. So, I mean, like on paper, yeah, totally, theoretically, I agree with you. But I don't think that applies everywhere right now yet.
Yep.
And I wish it did, but it doesn't.
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, I can't decide if I want to jump ahead, because this is very similar to some questions that we're going to tackle in a bit, or if we need to kind of stop and regroup and establish some context. And I think let's get context first.
You know what? You are the hosts, and I defer to your wisdom.
Well, let's talk about red light properties, because Because it's an awesome concept. We've got exorcism and real estate, and that journey to that beautiful print copy, as you mentioned, has been a long time coming. Mm-hmm. What have you learned along the way? Because this is your project. You do the whole thing yourself.
Uh-huh. So what have I learned?
What have you learned?
Fuck. I learned a lot. I learned a lot. My process evolved from the beginning of the book.
Okay. It
was a big leap because just in a technical sense, I went from doing stuff with leaning on 2D collage work to build the world to combining collage and 3D modeling and lighting. And it's just that was a huge leap for me, which makes my life a lot easier, except in the beginning when I have to build the models.
Right.
I learned a lot about large story structure and planning out, like arcing out characters' journeys and the series journey and arcing out the what happens to the company as we move through, like, you know, 7 or 12 different graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of story planned for Red Light Properties, and I really intend on working on it for years. And
So let me ask you, like, how you have, if you have this big, you know, these big story arcs planned, how loose is your scripting, and like, what's the process of creation? Is it these big beats that you have kind of planned to meet, and then how do you start drilling down into that to actually creating an issue?
That's a good question. I work in like broad strokes, and then I chop them up and drill down into them. I guess it's the only way I can really, like, I know what happens when I've got very detailed outlines for issues and less detailed outlines for the big beats that define the journey of the entire series.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, you know, everybody's arcs and what happens to them, and, you know,
do you find yourself readjusting as you're going on?
Of course, and that's the fun of it. Yeah. I mean, that's the journey is like, you know, you've got a character who's like, nope, I'm not going to die here.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm actually curious about. Like, you get to a point where, like, the story kind of speaks to you in a way that you didn't originally plan.
Yeah, of course. But I feel like that happens to me with everything I've ever worked on when it starts to get good.
Mm-hmm.
So when the characters disobey me, that's, you have to just take the back, you have to go get in the back seat and let them drive. That's, and I believe in that. And, you know, so I defer to them.
Hmm.
When the time
that's
comes.
Something that we've heard before from other creators who are writing and drawing, you know, they're sort of like so completely involved in their unique and individual storytelling process that you can respond more organically as that story evolves. And I think that is, in fact, unique to creators who are doing the whole thing themselves. I think you just have access to it in a different way.
Well,
so
I mean,
you can let the characters speak
themselves. And you can also move stuff around, like, in different areas of what becomes a comic, you know, like I can adjust the script, and then I can change the lettering to make the script feel different when you're reading it. You know what I mean? Like, you have access to all the, if it was a soup, you'd have, like, you can adjust the, you know, more meat, less potatoes, more cumin. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and you're the end result is the soup, but you have control over the recipe the whole way through.
That is the best analogy. I fucking love that. I love it.
Well, I have to be honest, like, Red Light Properties is one of the few, like, first, like, digital type comics that really grabbed me. Like, usually I find, like, something that looks digital, you know, when you, and it's hard to explain what that means, because a lot of stuff is done digitally these days, but that has a computerized feel in a certain way. If that makes sense, but it was one of the first books that I read, and I looked at it and said, like, I really like this. And I think it's because it's a mixed medium, and it's a different type of digital process than I'm used to seeing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And I think it's kind of an indicator. I'm kind of curious what your feeling is, kind of for the future, like, is that an indicator of the capability of comics or where you want to go with comics creation? Like using these different processes that I just haven't really seen before, especially with the character modeling.
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak to the future of comics. I've made that mistake before, and I only really want to speak for myself.
Sure.
But it's a process that I figured out on my own, and I've been developing really in a vacuum. You know, I would say since 2002, like I've been working digitally, and every project, every page that I do, I learn something else, and I'm just continuing with that. I mean, does it speak to the capability of comics? Yeah, of course. I mean, comics is an incredibly flexible language for storytelling. And, you know, I feel like I fit in there just fine. And I'm not saying this to you, but I get annoyed when I have to make all kinds of apologies for my stuff being digital or looking weird or, you know, la la la. And right. in reality, it's like, it's a fucking comic. It's characters in frames on pages.
Telling a story. Like,
you know, yeah, exactly, and
but part of the power of comics too, whether it's realistic or stylized, it's still art and it needs to emote, and
sure.
And digital or print or mixed medium or whatever, there you still have to retain that. And I think I had kind of this anachronistic kind of feeling, like, oh, it needs to be on paper in order for it to speak to me, you know.
Shocking that you would have that opinion.
But it's changed, and because I've seen the power of using technology to evoke that, and it's still, I think, for I'm just sort of, I don't know, I'm just being expository, but you know, this is one of the few books that really kind of like clicked that with me.
Oh, that's cool. Thank you. Do you when you read digital comics, do you love them less than you do when you read them on paper? Because I've noticed that I do.
I think I have less, and it's changing, but I think I have a less of a investment in it, if that makes sense. Like the tactile experience of reading something on paper, like holding it, is something that was... It's sort of genetic in a way at this point. It was ingrained in me at such an age. You know, it's the imprint of this is a comic book or this is a book, I'm holding it. Where if you're reading it on a screen or on a tablet, I don't have that same sort of physical connection.
Mm-hmm. I guess for me, like a comic book, a floppy comic book was always a disposable medium, and a trade paperback or a graphic novel was always something special, right?
Yeah.
Like that's my generation.
I agree.
So when you have, for me, I think that digital comics, reading them on a screen, is the new throwaway.
Sure, right. Yeah, there's nothing to it, right? There's nothing physical to it. It's just a digital, and you can delete it.
Right, and having a book of it feels more special, feels more deluxe.
Well, it's the artifact, because then you own the representation of the story. Right.
And it's the same reason why I might own something in individual issues and still buy the trade. And mm-hmm. I may own something digitally, and if it's then translated to print, I'm going to snap that up too, because right. I want that artifact. I think that the actual reading experience for me is not... It's not damaged by reading. I read almost everything digital at this point. In fact, I read everything in mm-hmm. digital. I'm in the process of getting rid of almost all of my individual print comics. But I often want that artifact, even if I don't immediately reread it in print, because that tangible experience is still something that I am drawn to on occasion. But the actual sitting down and reading something digitally, I don't lose anything from that interaction. Even though it might be throwaway kind of experience, it is my only experience right. now. And so it's still incredibly valuable.
I'm sorry I took us down this digital versus print rabbit hole. I swore I would never do this again.
No, it's cool. I think it's valid. It's a very valid like emotional reaction that people have, especially our age, because yeah. It's because we're going through this transition right now,
and the generation below us will have no such baggage.
I hope so. We talked about this a couple weeks ago because...
I wonder. I think the generation below us won't have this baggage. I think the generation below them will want it. Does that make sense?
We'll want what?
We'll want the physical.
Yeah. That was the point that you made in terms of collecting, that kids now, 12 to 15 or so, are going to have a drive to collect physical copies because it's going to be novel to them when they are adults, because it was less accessible or differently accessible than digital. They will swing back towards the print.
Well, I kind of equate it to music. Like, you can get any kind of music you want at any time now. So you see a generation of people who actively seek out like vinyl or even tapes because they're harder to get. You know, there's a barrier to entry to those mediums. They're cumbersome and it makes it appealing. Like, I think the accessibility of media makes it less valuable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take away from the stories. Like, stories are always, you know, you can always derive the pleasure from them, but I think people appreciate something when they have an investment of both their time and emotions.
Well, okay, so you asked me at the top of the show, what have I learned, right?
Right.
I have learned that print is better than digital. And this is having, like, held, you know, conferences on digital comics and mm-hmm. spoken about this at, like, MIT and shit like that, you know? And now that I've got a book, like my first book out since 2009, and all of a sudden, like, you have to understand, I've been working on Red Light Property since 2010. Mm-hmm. It's been digital since then until like last week. And I knew that I was doing, even like when I started, I was like, this is the best stuff I've ever done. This is the best work of my career thus mm-hmm. far, you know? I'm comfortable saying it because I've done 300 pages of it now. People didn't engage with it the same way. And now that there's a book out, like I'm having people that wouldn't have touched it. And now they're like, holy shit, this is amazing. How long have you been doing this? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, well, that's the power right there, you know? And I've had this series has jumped from web comics to DRM free downloads to Kindle, iBooks, and then Comixology. And like, I'm not exactly sure at what point anybody really gave a shit, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now they care. Now it means something. And
because
so,
it's in print.
You know, so I'm a believer, you know?
Yeah.
And I've run the road. And it was a big lesson for me because I think that there's a lot of magic to being able to get the work anytime, anywhere, from the cloud. I think that's mm-hmm. a very powerful thing, mm-hmm. but apparently it's not as powerful as having a beautiful book with glow-in-the-dark shit on the cover.
Well, I mean, look at the 90s era of comics with all those glow-in-the-dark comics. Those are the most, you know, cherished ones of the last 100 years.
Right, because you haven't seen the book yet.
No, we haven't seen that yet.
No, the book has glow-in-the-dark ghosts on the cover that are invisible from the internet.
Oh, awesome. So... See, you can't reproduce that digitally.
Right, I know. That's my whole point. So, cool. Well,
Dan, when we met last year, you had just come back from living in Brazil. And I remember that you were talking about readjusting to being back in this country. Uh-huh. So you grew up in Miami, right, where Red Light Properties is set?
Uh-huh.
And now you're in New York. And I'm curious about, like, cultural influences on your writing and in the way that you make choices about your characters.
Okay. And is that a question?
That's your question. Yep. As open-ended as I could possibly make it.
Okay. So what are my cultural reference points?
I think so. I think both from your experiences growing up in Miami and like your own background, but also the stories that you absorbed as you were traveling and when you were actually living like so far removed from mm-hmm. your comfort zone.
Right. Well, I guess it comes... I'm going to be really pretentious here, but I think it comes down to living with your eyes and ears and your mind really open.
Okay.
And it's sort of how I've always been. I mean, to a point. I think I was a dumb middle-class suburban idiot probably until I want to maybe like the age of 22.
That's not too bad.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But you know, I kind of shed that skin, you know, and then since then I try to engage with the world, and you know, even pre-internet and certainly post-internet or during internet, I think it's really important, like, for you to be an artist and for you to be a good engaged human being, to have that kind of relationship with everything around you, and the people and the stories and the influence and the information and the relationships. Like, it's, I think that's so key to being a human being. And the older I get, the more I see that so many people just aren't. Mm-hmm. And it's sickening and sad, but...
Well, don't you think a lot of people, we end up in our enclaves. We don't really get a lot of exposure, you know? And looking at the places you've lived, they're pretty culturally diverse. You know, you know, Miami has, and I think this comes through in Red Light Properties, there's a lot of different cultures coming together there.
Uh-huh, yeah, definitely. New York, too.
No, absolutely, yeah. And in Brazil, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was in São Paulo, which is like the New York of South America.
And it's changed so much, it seems like, over the last decade or so, because it's such a economic powerhouse now that you have, mm-hmm. you have all these European influences and all through South, you know, all the South American, North American kind of coming together. Like, that seems like that'd be a very unique cultural experience, especially at this time.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, and I was definitely, centered in an enclave down there. My wife is born and raised there, and she is from a Japanese community there.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the time that I spent was in the Japanese community, and I had a lot of dinners where I was the only gaijin at the table, and you know, that kind of stuff. But I guess what I wanted to say like 30 seconds ago is that I've never really identified or maybe admitted to having had an enclave, from Miami onward. I mean, I had groups of friends, but I was always the guy that had, like, I was never in a clique or a crew. I would have a couple friends in this clique and a couple friends in this clique. And, you know, if you zoom out, like, that's my group of friends, but they're not in any one group or community.
Uh-huh.
And I've always been that way, like from, you know, junior high school to now. And
well, what about in early life? Did you grow up in, you know, like, what about your parents? Was it a Jewish community or anything like that? Like, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, I have family down in Florida. My family's Jewish too, you know, and yeah. Especially in New York, when they were all kind of located in New York, it was very culturally centric, you know,
My neighborhood was Jewish growing up, but I went to public school, and then, which was not just Jewish, in Miami, and then I, in high school, I was in private school, which was mostly not Jewish, actually. It was more like old WASPy money.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say is that I've always moved around. I've never really had like roots for more than a couple years at a time until coming to New York. And even in New York, like you know, that's a stormy sea, like every day of your life. So like you tend to move around a lot too. So
how long have you been in New York?
I moved here in 98 and okay. Minus 3 years in Brazil and minus a year in Miami after 9/11. Where I started actually working on Red Light Properties for real was back in 2002. Mm. A lot of what Jude and Cecilia are was written during that time.
Oh, okay.
I've been working on this series for a very long time. It predates my stuff on Activate. It predates Shooting War. It's like, it's been around forever. And it was like, I used to refer to it as a joke before I had drawn anything. I used to call it the tumor. because the story just kept getting bigger and bigger in my skull, and I knew I was going to have to get it out somehow.
So when did you actually like start jotting notes and like kind of, you know, building the world?
The notes were happening and the world building was happening from 2002.
Okay.
But the actual art didn't start happening until I sold it to Tor and I started doing design work, which would be like fall of 2009.
Hmm.
I had done a lot of doodling, but like that's not really making comics and that's not really getting the story out. It's just planning and planning and planning. And I think I was afraid. I didn't really believe in myself as a storyteller for a while, and I knew that this was my baby and I wanted to...
Well, especially it seems like when people are first learning to be storytellers, they draw on things that they're very comfortable with, too, you know. And I don't know if that's the case with Red Light Properties, but the characters seem very kind of different than, you know, what we know about you publicly, you know. So it's interesting. It was that part of that fear, like these are very different kind of characters than what would be easy to write in a way.
No, I mean, no, not at all. They're all part of me. They all are these, little shards of myself, my own ego. That's for sure. Like Cecilia's me, Jude's me, Tori's me. I mean, there are other people too, but you know, the core that they speak from, uh-huh. they're all me in from different perspectives, and that's why they fight. It's like you. Like you think about yourself and your own ego and how it works. Your own. I'm talking about in like the metaprogramming sense, like the way your the software that is you functions.
Right. Yeah. Every internal struggle before you come to a decision. Right.
Right. And so you speak in like a Herman's head sense, if you want to lowball it, you know. But you've got a bunch of different voices sort of fighting for control of a situation, and you know that's like the essence of fiction to me.
Well, let's talk about kind of a different type of writing. So like Shooting War and 08, they're political stories. And that's not really something that's often touched on in a lot of comics. I think there's definitely that genre, but it doesn't seem to surface as much, or maybe it's cyclical, you know, depending on election years and that sort of thing. But does that make you feel more vulnerable as a writer working in nonfiction, or is it just another kind of storytelling? Like, how do you approach that versus, you know, something like Red Light Properties?
I'm more comfortable with fiction, but it's not for that reason. It's not I think that you're allowed to go crazy, but I think that your work lasts longer.
Mm-hmm.
I did a bunch of topical books, and like 6 weeks after their release, I don't think anybody gave a shit. And
just because they have a short kind of shelf life in that way.
Shelf life is short, and the attention span of the readership, I think, is shorter in topical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe like 5 years after or 10 years after, people will look back and be like, "Oh yes, this was a very important document of the era." but at the time, like it serves you in the short term because you hit news cycles and stuff like that. But it's not necessarily something that stays with people. And I'm making a generalization just based on my own experiences. But I think that when you can do a piece of fiction that I don't have to be topical because I can be
universal,
philosophical, yeah. And I can really, for me, it's I'm having so much more fun.
Wow.
And I don't really want to do any other political stuff unless I get like an opportunity I can't turn down, you know?
Like a really unexpected answer, but I completely understand the difference that you're describing, just in terms of like access, audience access.
Uh-huh.
You're right. It has an immediate interest and then it's going to drop off, mm-hmm. and time has to pass before it kind of becomes an artifact in and of itself.
Right.
And I've never really thought of kind of more political, topical writing in that way before.
Well, and it's also, I mean, and that answer, my answer is like, it's predicated on pure ego. Yeah.
Well, meaning that you want your stories to have longevity.
Yeah, but even more immediate than that, like when you finish a project that you spent 18 months slaving over a desk, you know, producing alone in a room because I work alone, you know, capital A. And so when that's done and then it's out in the world and then like 6 weeks later, nobody gives a shit, like that hurts, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't feel like that's going to happen with Red Light Properties. I feel like it has, it will have a longer tail and then it'll have a second volume and a third volume. And like, it has a life of its own. And I believe in it and I can see it already, you know? And that feels safer to me.
Yeah. With every new volume too, there'll be a resurgence in people discovering the series for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This really is a couch, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not kidding around.
All right, right on. Next.
Well, okay, so we talked about digital and print. And I think that you have been vocal about the opportunities and the challenges in the industry as a whole and working independently, where you are the one who has to be your marketer and your kind of biggest fan of your own work. What do you think could change or even can change at this point as we move forward as readers and creators, as publishers, as marketers to even that playing field, if that's even an option?
We're talking comics now, right?
Well, yeah, primarily.
I think with comics, I think what would help, God, this is such a complicated question. I think there needs to be another two or three publishers that if you could clone the opportunities that Image presents, for example, into another two or three different houses and just make room, I think the marketplace would transform. But I can't say that those things would that doesn't mean that there's an audience for it. It just means the work it would reach more people. Whether those people are out there or not, I don't know. But I think that's a big start. I feel like the amount of houses that will touch something like Red Light Properties or you know some of these other you know non-licensed, non-franchise things. I think that whole all those opportunities are very limited. And because of that, I think that the creators are expected. And I think this is really just true of the digital times that we're in, is that people, creators, content creators, to just broaden it as much as possible, are expected to, you have to do all the tap dancing and all the hustling and all, and then be brilliant and then be charming. And then, you know, it's really tough. Like my wife designs jewelry. She has to do the same shit that I do. In a totally different medium with a totally different industry specific hustle, you know? And what's interesting is that she and I, like over brunch, are having conversations about social media techniques.
Right.
Like it's my wife, you know?
Uh-huh.
And her hustle's different than mine. But the needs of, you know, being both a creator and a brand and a, you know, an entity are the same.
Right. It's like your personal digital savvy matters so much to selling your product such a separate thing from being a creative person. And it's very interesting to see that. Like it makes me wonder how many people are we never seeing what they're capable of because they don't know how to use Tumblr or, you know, they don't know how to find people on Twitter or something.
Exactly. And that's really sad. But it's really true. And, you know, 30 years ago, it was somebody who didn't have an agent or didn't live too far away to meet an agent. Or, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There's always something. And, and like, you have to be an entrepreneur and have that level of thinking and that level of focus in order to get out in front of people in general. I mean, I do believe the internet's amazing for leveling that field, but it doesn't totally level it.
Right.
So I think that's the end of that rant. But
well, do you struggle with the sort of the promotional side of, like, you know, it's something we kind of ask people a lot because you work, you know, capital A alone, and then you're also expected to be this public person to sell your product. Some people seem to find that invigorating and some people find that exhausting. I'm kind of curious which part of the spectrum you're closer to.
I find it both, but I've had, this is actually very personal, but while I was in Brazil, I was really isolated and I knew I was doing this great work, but I also knew that I was not finding an audience and I was too far away to be able to engage with people. And thus, I was like this lonely gringo Prometheus, you know, and I think I developed really bad social media habits over the course of a couple of years, just because I just sort of gave up and just kept making the work. And that's bad. But it was good in the sense that I got back to the US and I've got all this work in the can, and that's awesome, you know. Mm-hmm. But now I'm finding that I have to unlearn my lazy social media habits, and I've been training myself, and I've actually been consciously trying to be better at it, you know, mm-hmm. and thinking about it a lot and planning the that presence and that outreach. And I think it's important. And I think it's really easy to throw your hands up and just sort of consign yourself to bad habits. But the problem with that is that people don't find the work anymore from that you love.
Right.
And more than anything, you know, you want your children to be happy and to grow. And the, you know, like this series is, like I said, it's children to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's important that it flourishes.
Yeah. And the way especially with independent comics is you have to be a constant promoter of your own work, but it's more than just, you know, a sales pitch constantly too. Like social media, I find fascinating because it's having to engage with people in very specific ways in order to get them interested in what you create. And it's really like, as kind of an outside observer, it's fascinating to see the people that are good and the people that are bad at it and how it reflects upon how their work is received as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't consider myself good at it, but I'm trying and I'm learning and I watch people that I think are and how they do it. Cause you know, it's the easiest thing in the world is just fart out a bunch of promo links every day on Twitter.
Yeah.
And all you do is lose followers.
Right. Like, right.
It's really about talking to people, and that's Twitter. And then like every network has its own flavor and its own, like, I'm not on Pinterest. Pinterest is probably really a good thing for me, but I don't know if I can handle another one right now, you know, and I'd love to get rid of Facebook because I only interact with people that all they do is like things. I don't have conversations on Facebook that I think are interesting.
But there's still a value in that, because even though somebody might be liking it, it still becomes part of their consciousness too.
Right. Of course. So, you know, I feel like, you know, this present is still being written, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just important to be engaged and to pay attention. And, you know, it's, for me, the battle with it is that doing the online persona thing takes a lot of energy that I really just want to do the work,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if I didn't have to do this stuff at all, and all I had to do was like go to my studio and fucking write and draw and be great, that's ideal for me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm also meeting people doing the tap dance that I like, and I'm making friends and I'm making connections and I'm finding readers, and like that's gratifying too, but it does eat into the time that I need. Like, you know, we only live so long, you know?
Right.
And like, I've got a lot of story I want to get out, and I, you know, I'd rather be writing and drawing than tweeting.
Mm-hmm. That's a good quote.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's really, but that's a battle, because you know it's like you know, when you're playing a video game and you go underwater and you get that oxygen gauge that starts immediately going down. Like, that's your life, man. You know.
Yeah.
And you know, you never know. You never know when you're gonna go or how much you got left. And I certainly don't want to be a professional tweeter.
Well, you know, it's always good to have as a backup plan.
Yeah.
I don't know what it pays, but you know,
right?
Maybe someday. Well, okay. How about on a lighter note? Let's talk about what you're reading or watching for fun these days. Like, Are there any comics you want to recommend for people that you're into right now, or even books or media? What do you do to disconnect when you need to relax the brain from a day of creation?
I do all kinds of stuff. I read comics, I'm just reading and really enjoying the Superior Spider-Man stuff. Uh-huh. It's fun as shit. And it kind of reminds me of being a kid reading Spider-Man, uh-huh. which I know is a nice feeling. I really like the Bunker, which is a digital comic that's coming out in print.
Yeah, I think that is out this week. The first issue is out from Oni in print this week.
Yeah, really. I read it digital, and it's great. The story is by Josh Fialkov, and the art is Joe Infernari, and that's a really cool story. God, there's so many. I mean, I could just totally dump out now, but Mind Management, the Matt Kent book, is great.
Mm-hmm.
I really like. Maybe I'm late to the party, but I think Scott Snyder is a really good writer. His Vertigo book, The Wake, is awesome.
Yeah.
And his Batman stuff is, like, you know, other than the fact that it's got Batman in it, it's pretty cool. I don't know what else. But I, you know, I read a lot of big boy books too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was nasty. I know.
I'd say Mind Management falls into the big boy books category.
Yeah, I think he was talking about not comics.
Yeah, I meant not comics, which is nasty. let me see. For pure decompression, like I just had a vacation, like my first vacation, like a year and a half, and I took volume 4 of Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea cycle.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I love, and I'm reading them for the first time, and the fourth book, which is Tehanu, I took that to the beach with me, which was just the best thing ever.
I read Left Hand of Darkness as maybe it was like 13 or 14, and then like devoured as many of her books as I could after that.
Have you read The Dispossessed? That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think that would be my favorite of hers, actually.
Yeah, I think me too. But her sci-fi stuff is so different from the fantasy stuff, and it like the tone is, and I really love Earthsea because it's like it gives you that kind of woodland pastoral vibe of Tolkien, but without all the fucking moralization and good and evil. You know,
and just the density of all the name, like the biblical kind of density of stuff you have to memorize.
But it's also just really like wise and very gray and very open minded and sensitive. And I don't know. I think they're amazing. So I have 4 and 5 in front of me, but I haven't dug in yet. What else do I have? Do you know Mary Roach? She writes these like kind of tongue in cheek science books.
She's amazing.
Yeah, so she's got a book. I think they reissued it with a new title, but I got a used hardcover of it called Spook.
And it's, that's one of the best.
Yeah, so I have that. I've been digging into that lately. I don't think I'll probably be done with it by the time the audience hears this podcast. but that's been really cool. And of course, the nice thing about that is that it's a crack and read that also feeds into my series.
Yeah.
So that's cool. And then I'm reading this other Cook's memoir travelogue it's a British girl in the 90s who lives in Sichuan, and she's the first Western student in the Sichuan cooking academy, and it's all about like going like making her tongue Chinese instead of British, and it's really cool. She's written a bunch of cookbooks, and she's supposed to be like the premier chef who brought Sichuanese food to the West. Her name is Fuchsia Dunlop, and that book is really cool. I'm a big foodie. I love food, and I love that you can, like, one of the things I love about living in New York City is that you can travel the world with your mouth. You know, I'm serious. Like, it's really fun, and like I go to
like finding out about cultures through the food that they make.
Yeah. Like there was this Star Wars book series that followed Return of the Jedi that came out when I was in high school, and they're not good stories, but there was this character, this admiral, you know, with blue skin, and he said when he was talking about taking over a planet system, and he would listen to their music and eat their food. And he said that the only way to know a culture is to absorb their art and eat their food. And I was like, that's actually really true. Like, as a junior or sophomore or whatever in high school, I was like, wow, that's actually very astute for a Star Wars novel. And so, but it's true. Like, I moved here and I got into like all these different cuisines, and like, I'm discovering stuff all the time, you know? And, it's not like there are any new nations. It's just, I come across them.
Right. You can only have so much exposure over a lifetime, and it's not.
Right. So that's fun, you know? And then, you know, the stuff that really gets me is like, wow, I want to go there and I want to do it for real. But it's a great sampler. You know, like I recently started becoming aware of like, Filipino food, which is incredible, you know, and it's Filipino food is like Malaysian and a little Chinese mixed with Latino food. Mm-hmm. And it's like real porky and fried, and but then you've got like these coconut milk sauces and sweet stuff and seafood, and it's just it's fantastic. And I was totally ignorant of it until maybe like a year and a half ago. So, you know, another rant completed.
No, this was really good, Dan. This is like super fun and very informative. I'm a little sad that we can't hang out in Seattle this year, but I hope you have a good time in Austin. That sounds like an excellent opportunity. Are you speaking at South by Southwest? Or
I am. I'm going to do a talk about red light properties, probably like a low key thing on like one of the quickie stages. I don't think I'm not on the schedule as far as I know yet, but they have like there's a stage or two stages in the different cafes, and you can get on and kind of like catch people.
Yeah.
But I'm also going to do some, I'm going to do a comic shop event, and I'm going to do an indie bookstore event as well while I'm there. And I also did, the reason that I'm going instead of the, instead of Emerald City is because Emerald City, like, I couldn't get IDW to answer me about whether I could sign books, and I'm not doing any, nobody invited me to be on panels. And South by Southwest, like, they added the, you know, they do music, film, and interactive. And then last year they added gaming. And so they asked me to do the gaming poster for their expo and awards.
Nice.
And, So I got to go.
That seems like a very good culture too for promoting the book and that festival especially.
I've been to South by a couple. I think this will be my fourth time going as a pro. And I went once in college, just on like a really drugged out road trip. And you know, it's great. It's sort of like Comic-Con for really smart people. but it has that same like manic energy, like, holy shit, what's next? What's on the schedule? What can I do? Who are you? Oh my God, I love your stuff. It's like that, like where everybody you meet is somehow connected. And it's just that the net is a lot wider and a lot more inclusive. Mm-hmm. And I love it. So, yeah, I am bummed not to go to Seattle though, because I had a blast last year and I made a lot of really good friends.
But it sounds like Austin is going to be a really good time for you too.
I think it's gonna be hectic. And also, like, I really like eating tacos.
Wow, there you go, right there, that's the decision done.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I think we're gonna let you go at this point.
Okay.
I want to thank you for joining us on the couch this week. Hopefully it was a therapeutic and maybe a little bit cathartic experience.
I feel cleansed.
Good.
Well, thanks for having me. This was really fun. This was a very interesting conversation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And thanks to everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, on comicstherapy.com. We'll talk to you next week.
World, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating, but you
Tell me over.